Welcome to It's a Crime. I'm your host, Margaret McLean, and I'm back with more on this contentious case.
Commonwealth v. Cameron Reed, indictment 22CR117.
Did Karen Reed kill her boyfriend with her car, or did somebody else beat him up?
He's got scratch marks all up and down his arm that are completely unexplained.
The defendants then made several statements to her indicating, I hit him, I hit him, I hit him, I hit him.
He's got two black eyes, appears to have a broken nose.
I tried to save his life. Yeah. I tried to save his life at 6 in the morning. I was covered in his blood. I was the only one trying to save his life.
There's something else going on here.
She indicated that she first observed the broken taillight in the morning and did not know how she broke it.
The remaining evidence will drive a stake through the heart of this prosecution.
And it also means that his body was moved.
So the defense is saying John's body was moved. Let's find out where they're going with that. If you have any questions while you're listening, feel free to jot them down and leave me a message or a comment on my Facebook page, and that's It's a Crime with Margaret McLean. You can also go to my website, itsacrimemedia.com, where I have photographs identifying all the major characters along with a timeline of events. In episode 1, I discussed the prosecution's case, and in this one, I'll be highlighting the defense. There's one important thing to keep in mind right off the bat. At trial, the prosecution has the burden of proof. The defense doesn't have to prove anything. So what's the burden of proof in this case? For the second-degree murder charge against Karen Reed, the prosecution must prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, that her car struck the victim, John O'Keefe, caused his death, and that she intended to kill him or cause such great bodily harm that it's likely he'd die from his injuries. Now that's a pretty heavy burden for the prosecution. Back when I was assigned cases, I'd come up with a theory from the very beginning and carry it through to the closing arguments. The theory of the prosecution's case here is that Karen intentionally backed into John with her car and left him for dead. In episode 1, we discussed the strengths of their case. Assistant District Attorney Lally will use an accident reconstructionist who will testify that her car backed up at a very high rate of speed and quickly accelerated. They'll also produce pieces of her taillight that they found at the scene. People will testify that they heard her admit that she hit John with her car, and he'll produce evidence that the couple had been fighting. Now, somebody reached out to me through Facebook messages and asked if John's niece and nephew will be testifying. Absolutely, because they saw the fighting and the instances of jealousy. John's niece will testify that during a New Year's trip to Aruba, shortly before John died, Karen accused him of kissing someone else. That would go right to motive. The prosecution would argue Karen was so angry that she intentionally hit him with her car. So let's focus on the defense. Right away, I see they've developed a theory for their case, which they will carry through to closing arguments. That theory is that John was severely beaten inside the house at 34 Fairview and tossed outside to die in the snow. So how did they come up with the theory that somebody else committed this crime and Karen's completely innocent? After her arrest, as you can imagine, Karen's in shock. If you look at footage from her initial arraignment, she appears really scared. Quite different from what you'll see now, which is a much more confident Karen Reed. So early on, she hires Boston defense attorney David Yannetti. I like Dave. He's a former prosecutor, and he tried some big cases at the Middlesex DA's office. I'd describe him as very passionate, articulate, and quite intelligent. So how did they come up with the theory that somebody else committed this crime? It's interesting. An anonymous tip was called into Yannetti's office. A man with a gravelly voice said, "Your client is innocent. John was beaten up by Brian Elbert and his nephew. They broke his nose, and when John didn't come to, Brian and a federal agent dumped his body on the front lawn." That must have been pretty astounding, getting that phone call. Brian Elbert is another Boston police officer. Remember, he owned the home at 34 Fairview. John was found dead in the snow on his property. And the federal agent they're talking about is Brian Higgins. I mean, he's with the ATF. And Colin Elbert is the nephew, and he was still a teenager. Did a fight really break out at that after party? Why would a Boston cop, a federal agent, and a teenager cover up a murder? Attorney Dave Yannetti must have been shocked. Like, where do we go from here? Where do we even start investigating this? Trying this case was going to get ugly for the defense. Pointing the finger at a federal agent and a cop and accusing them of covering up a murder. These types of accusations were also going to throw the case into the national spotlight. So they reached out to Alan Jackson. He's a famous criminal defense lawyer out of Los Angeles. He defended Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey. When he took a look at John's autopsy photographs, he said, "How the F are they saying he got those injuries?" It didn't look like John was struck by a car. It looked like he got in a fight. That's when they went to the press and broadcast their accusations of a massive law enforcement conspiracy. Here's Karen on the courthouse steps with her lawyers.
"So it feels we're the only ones fighting for the truth of what happened to John O'Keefe. And me and my family and my attorneys and my team have marshaled every resource to get to the truth. It just feels like no one else wants it."
"So you didn't do it?"
"We know who did it, Steve. We know. And we know who spearheaded this cover-up. You all know."
"Yes, we do."
"And no, she didn't do it. No, she didn't do it. This is an innocent woman. She didn't do it."
"I tried to save his life. Yeah. I tried to save his life at 6 in the morning. I was covered in his blood. I was the only one trying to save his life."
She didn't do it. That's the crux of their case. We'll start right off with the autopsy photos. Do they really show that John was the victim of a deadly fight? Or was he struck by a car? Here's attorney Yannetti to that point.
"He's got scratch marks all up and down his arm that are completely unexplained. He's got two black eyes, appears to have a broken nose. There's something else going on here."
Let's dive right into that. I've seen the autopsy photographs here. There's a deep cut on the back of John's head. His eyes are dark purple and closed shut. His nose is black and blue. And there are deep scratches and puncture wounds on his right arm, which the prosecution claims were the result of road rash. And this is what Attorney Jackson says about that.
"And the Commonwealth looks at these wounds and says, nothing to see here. Why are we looking at this? This is, you're following a red herring, basically. This is just a road rash."
Well, what does he think caused the wounds on John's right arm?
"And there's deep scratch wounds, puncture wounds that are indicative of claw marks and bite marks from a large animal."
An animal attack. How does that play into the defense theory that John was beaten up inside the house by law enforcement, dragged outside, and left for dead? Well, first he points out that the injuries run from John's right bicep to his mid-forearm. He's right-handed. Why is that important?
"Mid-biceps and mid-forearm that you might put in front of your face or your body if a large animal was attacking you."
So it looks like he's saying that John was trying to protect himself with his right arm over his face. He also notes there were no other injuries like this present on John's body. And then the defense discovers that Brian Elbert owned a German Shepherd named Chloe at the time of John's death.
"The dog was, quote, not great with strangers, end quote. That's a dog owner's euphemism for the dog bites."
This topic really intrigues me. So I reached out to former homicide investigator and national forensic expert, Dr. Ken Lang. And this is what he has to say.
"The arm is really interesting because at first I looked at him, I thought, it looks like defensive wounds, and there's a couple there. And then there was one not too far from the elbow that almost looked like a bit of a stab wound, like slashing and such. I've not seen vehicle accidents where I've had that kind of injury. If he's struck in the head and that causes the contusion, as they allege, then what did the arm strike that would have caused all those lacerations? But then I started looking up some animal bites and scratches and stuff, and I noticed that the long slashes aren't necessarily clean and straight as they would be with an edged weapon. They are a little off. They have a little wave to them, if you will. And that is consistent with an animal that is slashing with their claws. If you look at the right towards the wrist, the one at the far end, there is like four slashes and they're parallel to one another. And when I saw that, I immediately thought that could be a raccoon. With animals, typically when they attack, you see patterns. So if they're biting, you're going to see a number of puncture wounds or abrasions that mimic their mouth or their teeth, right? It has happened where animals will slash and like one claw goes deeper than the others, and it just leaves one wound there when they have four claws. Others not so. It depends on the animal.
If you guys are curious, I have a photo of those injuries on my website for discussion at itsacrimemedia.com. I also observed the trained German Shepherds in action with the police in Brockton. They really go for people's arms. I posted a video of that training session on my Facebook page at It's a Crime with Margaret McLean. It's so important to the defense that they went out and hired one of the top medical examiners in the country with more than 12,000 autopsies under his belt.
And he concluded to a scientific certainty that these wounds are from an animal attack.
So why did they go and spend so much money for an expert about a dog bite? Because it plays into the theory of their case that John was beaten inside the house, attacked by the Elbert's dog, and then dragged outside where he died in the snow. Attorney Jackson criticizes the police and prosecution for not inquiring further about the odd nature of the wounds on John's right arm. It's part of the whole cover-up. They didn't do it because they were afraid of the answer.
It's because they know that the answer completely obliterates their case. Their theory of homicide would fold if they got the true answers to these questions. The answer exculpates Karen Reed, and the answer inculpates Brian Albert. That's because if that dog was inside the house that night, not on the front lawn, not in the front yard, but inside the house, and these injuries were suffered or sustained at the time John O'Keefe was killed, then that means John O'Keefe was inside the house when he was killed. It also means that his body was moved. That's consistent with the facts that we also know to be true, which is not one person that was in that house and ultimately exited that house from that party that night, not one, saw John O'Keefe's body in the front yard. That's because he wasn't there yet. Multiple people walked out of the house who had no reason to lie about that. A 200-pound man, 6'2", lying in the front yard.
I'm not so sure if they can sell that to the jury. It was snowing and dark out, so it's very possible that nobody saw him lying in the snow. But one point they may be able to drive home to the jurors is the fact that there is a conflict of interest for the lead state police investigator in this case. In my experience, jurors hold the police to a high standard. They don't like to see any kind of hanky-panky going on behind the scenes. So let's explore that right now. The defense argues that the lead investigator, State Police Trooper Michael Proctor, has an unethical conflict of interest. He should never have been assigned to this case. And why is that? Because he's from Canton, and he's friends with the Elbert family. John's body was found on Brian Elbert's front lawn. The jurors are going to wonder about that. Is this guy actually investigating his own friends and acquaintances? There's most definitely a hint of impropriety.
Michael Proctor's mother has described the Albert family as the Proctor's second family. Michael Proctor told witnesses who showed up to testify before the grand jury that Brian Albert is the salt of the earth. Michael Proctor's wife has posted about how much they love Colin Albert. The Proctors have constantly been photographed with the Alberts going back over a decade. We've shown that Michael Proctor's in a wedding party with Colin Albert. Colin Albert was the ring bearer at Michael Proctor's sister's wedding. It's so clear that Michael Proctor was both conflicted and corrupt.
I'm spending time on this because when I prosecuted cases and there was even the slightest evidence of a conflict of interest for the police, the jurors would frown at me, like they'd be saying, I can't believe you're even prosecuting this case. And this one gets even worse.
Michael Proctor texted his own family members discussing the specifics of having Julie Albert babysit for his toddler child.
Julie is also very close friends with Trooper Michael Proctor's sister. Listen to this.
3 days after John O'Keefe was killed, Michael Proctor's sister texts Michael Proctor very specifically and writes the following, quote, just saw Julie, and Julie said when all this is over, she wants to give you, Michael Proctor, a thank you gift.
A gift? Well, that certainly doesn't look good. The Boston Police Department also opened up its own internal affairs investigation on Michael Proctor. I was curious, so I asked Dr. Lang his opinion as a former homicide detective if the state police should have reassigned Michael Proctor as soon as they discovered there was a conflict.
I think that that would have been the smart move to do, because then you have an independent person in this case who isn't going to have those biases coming in and potentially influence. We use this concept in the court system with juries, right? We take and we poll the jurors as we're seating them to determine if they have biases and stuff. I mean, if we go to that great length in our system, on the back end where we're in the courtroom, then we certainly need to be doing that on the front end as well whenever we think that there might be any type of a conflict of interest.
Dr. Lang makes a very good point. In addition, the U.S. Attorney's Office convened a special grand jury to investigate law enforcement's handling of this very case. Now that's a very unusual move. Overall, it will be easier for the defense team to attack Trooper Proctor throughout the entire trial. The defense claims that Trooper Proctor planted pieces of Karen's taillight at the crime scene several days after he took possession of her car.
In order for that, the microscopic supposed pieces of taillight to have any evidentiary value, you have to trust who had custody of them, which means you have to trust Michael Proctor. And I question, how on earth can anyone trust Michael Proctor?
They're even accusing him of tampering with John's clothing.
He had every reason to sprinkle tiny pieces of taillight that he had seized into the clothing that he alone took, so that the lab would later find it weeks later, and sure enough, they did.
Here's another accusation against Trooper Proctor, having to do with a significant witness, Brian Loughran. He'll testify that he plowed Fairview Road in the early morning hours. Did he see John's body lying in the snow at that time? The jurors are going to sit forward and take notes on this one. Believe me.
At the outset of this case, State Trooper Michael Proctor submitted a report stating that Fairview Road in Canton had not been plowed during the early morning hours of January 29th, 2022. He claimed in that report that Michael Trotta at the DPW had told him during a phone call that he had with him after John O'Keefe was killed. We did not take Michael Proctor's word for that, and thank God we didn't, because we learned that was a lie. Rather than take Michael Proctor's word, we instead sent our investigator to speak to Mr. Trotta in February of 2022. He directed us to another man who led us to the plow driver who did plow the street. Our investigator interviewed plow driver Brian Loughran within a couple of weeks of John O'Keefe's death. Mr. Loughran told us what he has now told Michael Proctor, now that Proctor finally got around to speaking to him a year and a half after the fact. Shortly after John O'Keefe died, Brian Loughran told us that he did plow the street in front of 34 Fairview, made a pass by there at 2:30 in the morning on January 29th. And when he passed that house, there was not a lot of snow that had fallen. Visibility was good. The lights were working on his plow. He passed right by the area where John O'Keefe's body would have been if Karen Reed had actually struck him with her vehicle. And he confirmed that at 2:30 a.m., plowing that area, there was no body there. And Mr. Loughran was firm with Trooper Proctor. There was no body. And he told him, not only was there no body, but if there had been a body there, he would have seen it. He left Michael Proctor in the Commonwealth no wiggle room. The plow driver's testimony should end this case. To put it simply, no body at 2:30 a.m. means Karen Reed is innocent. Forget about all the other evidence that points to her innocence, but this one fact alone prevents the Commonwealth from ever convicting her. No body at 2:30 a.m., she is innocent. But, Your Honor, it's not just that he saw no body at 2:30 a.m. After that, he saw a Ford Edge parked right in the area where John O'Keefe's body was later found. Whoever moved that Ford Edge to that location in the early morning hours of January 29th, that mysterious driver and his or her accomplices likely know who beat up and killed John O'Keefe, and that person knows how John O'Keefe received all of the scratch marks and bite marks to his arm.
Also, around that time in the morning, Brian Elbert placed a phone call to Brian Higgins, the ATF agent who destroyed his phone.
We have evidence that Brian Elbert had expressed hostility toward John O'Keefe as well. And we know that he initiated a phone call with Brian Higgins at 2:22 in the morning. He reached out to Brian Higgins.
Well, let's talk about Brian Higgins. The defense is saying not only did he commit this crime, but he's also in on the massive cover-up to frame Karen. Well, what's his motive? Believe it or not, an affair. A romantic entanglement with Karen Reed. Higgins told investigators that Karen, quote, made an advance on him and gave him a kiss on the lips 2 weeks before John's death. They also exchanged numerous romantic text messages. They had crushes on each other. The defense will argue that's motive for a fight between John O'Keefe and Brian Higgins. And by the way, after John's body was found, Brian Higgins destroyed his phone.
Breaks the SIM card and throws the phone away.
The jury's going to get a kick out of that one. As the defense advances the theory of its case, that John was severely beaten inside the Elbert home, they'll also attempt to show the jury how the real culprits covered up their crimes. That's when Jennifer McCabe's Google search comes into play.
The Commonwealth suppressed one of the most obvious pieces of exculpatory evidence in the entire case, and that was a piece of evidence that they know torpedoes their entire case and their theory of this case, and that's Jennifer McCabe's Google search at 2:27 a.m., how long to die in cold.
That's significant because if proven, it means that Jennifer McCabe already knew that John was lying out in the snow around 2:30 in the morning, which lends credibility to the theory that there was a fight inside the house and John was beaten and thrown into the snow. The prosecution claims that she really didn't Google at that time. They claim she entered the search into an open tab later at 5:30 when she was with Karen and they discovered John in the snow. Both sides will have to produce expert testimony on that because, quite frankly, it confuses me and it will definitely confuse the jury. The defense also accuses the prosecution of withholding this evidence before the grand jury. Listen to this.
The Commonwealth suppressed one of the most obvious pieces of exculpatory evidence in the entire case, and that was a piece of evidence that they know torpedoes their entire case and their theory of this case, and that's Jennifer McCabe's Google search at 2:27 a.m., how long to die in cold. They did not present this evidence. And should the Commonwealth once again stand up in some sort of desperate pitch to dispute that time and this critical evidence, the court should note the following. Not only does the Cellebrite report confirm the search and the time of that search, not only do our experts confirm the search and the time of that search, but now a Quantico-trained special agent with the FBI's Regional Computer Forensic Lab, in other words, the United States Federal Bureau of Investigation, also specifically confirms that that search was made on Jennifer McCabe's phone and it was made on or before 2:27 and 40 seconds a.m. on January 29th, 2022. That fact, Your Honor, is no longer open for debate.
And that's the gist of the case for the defense. You can expect some fiery cross-examinations in this one. I'll be following this trial and providing you with more episodes for the duration. So be sure to tune in to the next episode of It's a Crime. I'm your host, Margaret McLean. Thank you for listening.